Welcome to the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. My name is Nicholas Underwood. On this episode, I had the extraordinary opportunity to sit down with General Mike Minahan, the commander of Air Mobility Command. Since October 2021, General Minahan has rapidly accelerated change in his command, driving his force to create an irreversible momentum and warfighter mindset. He has challenged his airmen to explode into theater, sense and seize opportunities, and focus on lethality. In our conversation, we discuss lessons learned from Operation Allies Refuge, the recent Pacific Mobility Guardian exercise, and his approach to leadership and risk acceptance. Please join us as we discuss joint force maneuver at speed, breadth, and depth. Well, sir, I'm incredibly humbled to have you as a guest today. Thank you so much for giving me your time and then speaking to our audience as well. So thank you.
Great. Hey, we're happy to host you here in the cornfields of Illinois. Home of Air Mobility Command, certainly, and then Transcom right across the street. This is Mobility and Transportation Headquarters, so we're proud to have you.
All right, thank you, sir. So let's just start by discussing some of the challenges you foresaw in the operations laid out, foresaw in the future environment, and
right.
Some of the challenges in the command with your mobility manifesto, the charge you gave airmen going forward.
You know, I was hired for this job for my experience in the Pacific. So about 10 years in the Pacific, General Brown gave me an order and a challenge coming into this job. He said, hey, go faster. Not a comment on any of my predecessors, simply a comment on the changing in the environment and also his accelerate, change, or lose, essentially his manifesto, right? So I know how to go fast. I certainly have a lot of experience in the Pacific. That doesn't make me an expert by any means, but I knew very early in my tenure that I wanted to use the lessons we learned in OAR and the evacuation of Kabul and move forward pretty aggressively. So we started very simply. We put a map on the table of the Pacific, and we started talking in very basic terms about what we were going to do if this were going to go down tomorrow. Not 5 years from now, not 10 years from now, but how do we really get after the urgency of the now and the go faster piece? So we had some work to do to be able to describe what we were going to do. I established a little team. I don't know if I'm famous or not. At least I do these cheesy bumper stickers. We established a thing we called Fight Club, which was a weapons officer centric, A3, A5 centric to really lay down the plan of what we're going to do. It was a big challenge to the headquarters. Like I said, we started out with the map on the table. It eventually grew to a map on the stage, a giant map on the stage with dozens of weapons officers and weapons instructors and others. And then it grew to a map on the hangar floor. So what I'm describing in a few seconds here actually took over a year to get done to the point where we could really answer, what are we going to do? So out of Fight Club then came the manifesto. So released the manifesto at AFA 2 falls ago. And, you know, this was about really gripping the entire mobility community on the effort and not just the headquarters. 4 basic premises of the mobility manifesto. 1, airmen are the magic. 2, lethality matters most. 3, we are the joint force maneuver. And 4, we've got to invest our American tenacity now and win, not to win, and win. With that as the premise, we look to build on the conversation and make it a part of who we are all the way down to the newest levels of airmen in our echelons. That was the charge from General Brown. That's essentially the structure that we established to get after it. I think you'll ask me some future questions about once that's established, how do we get about rehearsing it? So that's where Mobility Guardian comes into the conversation. And then certainly a segue into Beyond the Manifesto, what I'm looking for in the future.
Let's talk about Mobility Guardian. You laid out 3 challenges there. It said explode into theater, sense and seize opportunities to make adversaries consider, focus on lethality.
There you go.
And so those 3, hopefully we can kind of talk a little bit about those.
Right. Well, the majority of our force is, use a Hawaii term here, in the mainland, in the continental United States, certainly. And this is a direct tie back to what we learned in OAR. So when I say we are the joint force maneuver, everybody is counting on us to not only get them to the fight, but then to put them in a position of advantage, which is what maneuver is, right? We put people and units and capabilities in a position of advantage so they can have a lethal effect. So this OAR, as successful as it was from the mobility aspect, it was harder than it needed to be. We put crews in places that they shouldn't have been in to work what airmen do, right? They work miracles and they fill the gap between what they should have and what they do have. So it was incredibly important that we looked hard at those lessons and that we as a headquarters made sure that in future evolutions that we're not putting airmen in positions where it's their courage that makes a difference, and that there's always a point for courage, but we've got to make sure that we're doing everything we can to make them successful. So we took the lessons learned from OAR. We know we have to explode into theater. We know the joint force needs to get there. We wanted to make a statement on America's readiness and America's will. So we absolutely wanted to demonstrate that we could get there in a hurry. And then we didn't want to take any shortcuts. We didn't want to white card anything. We didn't want to make the exercise easy. You and I have both been on exercises where you deploy a week in advance. All your cargo's there when you arrive, or you get a couple of days to adjust to the time zone. And we did not take those shortcuts. So we didn't create a space and time where it was easy for us during Mobility Guardian, presidential move to Europe for the NATO summit, vice presidential moves. There were some storm responses and stuff. So all the normal things were happening, the support to Ukraine, all the normal stuff was happening. You know, so we did not fence it off in the normal way possible. We tested our crew's ability to not only deploy, but to transition from deploy to employ without any time in between. Hacked the mission with minimal cargo or with no cargo or equipment that they were expecting to support themselves. So all those things we put on the shoulders of our amazing airmen that fly, fix, and support, and we expected them to work hard and figure it out on their own. And it won't surprise you, they did great, but it also won't surprise you that we learned a lot of hard lessons there. So the bottom line on that one is take OAR, celebrate it for what it was, but also do a hard mirror check and say, how can we as an institution do better to put our airmen in a more advantageous place? And then design an exercise that gets after those things and test our resolve, test our willingness to be tough on ourselves, test our willingness to actually do a lesson learned instead of a lesson observed. And then you'll see, and I'm sure certain we'll talk about as we move forward here, you know, we learned some hard lessons on Mobility Guardian too. And then what do you do with those? And just the cycle repeats and you just keep getting better.
Sir, before we get into Mobility Guardian, there's a mindset shift that comes very clearly out in the Mobility Manifesto and a lot of what you're saying right now, that
right.
Very aggressive, lean forward mentality. And beyond the manifesto, you talk a little bit about OAR. There was a planning assumption that AMC was going to make this work. It's going to happen almost as if just magically happened. It had been relegated to a lot of business type of speak. There's a hard push to move, and you've even used the word maneuver. Hey, we are a maneuver force. We are not supply. We're not logistics. So I want to hopefully kind of really pull that out just a bit before we go into it, because there is a significant shift. It is not just, let's test our ability to supply. Let's push our airmen to be at the tip.
You got it. So to start at the beginning, and why I used airmen are the magic in the first manifesto is because they are. Even on the fourth bullet in the manifesto, we talk about American tenacity. So I've got no concerns when it comes to our airmen's ability to get after the mission and to make the mission happen, make the mission successful. That spans from my earliest times in the command all the way to today. But I want to be as aggressive as a staff, making sure that we are setting the conditions for everything you described, not only putting them in advantageous positions, but also making sure that we are celebrating the warfighter culture and that we understand that our role is much more than just the bus ride, the cargo, the gas station in the sky. Everybody's success depends on us. We are the most relied upon force in the history of warfare. Now, you're smart. You're smarter than me, and you come from what I think is the epicenter of Air Force intellect at Maxwell Air Force Base, but I am begging for someone to challenge me on that statement. I don't make that statement from a position of arrogance nor a position seeking sympathy. I say that because my force needs to know, and the forces we are supporting need to know, that their success, our success, depends on Air Mobility Command being able to put everybody into positions of advantage. So that's maneuver. Of course, there's a logistics side of my life. There's all the things that come in the traditional way of looking at mobility. But the reality is, because of the force we have, mostly based in the continental United States, because of the potential adversaries that exist as outlined by the National Defense Strategy, is that Air Mobility Command, mobility, is going to be the most relied upon force in the history of warfare. So I intend to put a force on the field that's ready. I don't intend to have that as a direct task or an implied task, and for us to take the field and not be successful. So as successful as OAR was, it needs work, both on the mobility side and the joint force side that needs to be supported. So develop two problem statements, which are essentially, we're not ready to fight and win inside the first island chain. And the second problem statement was joint force isn't as ready, integrated, or agile as it could be. That essentially was the framework moving into Mobility Guardian. Let's see if we can chisel away at those problem statements and put us in a position to say that we improve both of those. From idea to execution was about 14 months. Even though Mobility Guardian existed in the past, it did not exist in the Pacific theater. I mean, you can't know the Pacific until you served in the Pacific. And I could not be more proud of what this headquarters did to make that come true. We're going to enjoy the fruits, which are the insights, right? The fruits of this exercise were insights. We don't draw conclusions from exercises. We gain insights. And so with those insights, what are we going to do? We got a precious gift with those insights. What are we going to do? And that's where Beyond the Manifesto kicks in.
That is a significant charge to reframe the way in which our airmen look at Air Mobility Command. I think you use the word, we are the Joint Maneuver Force, which is exactly what you've been saying. That helps me really understand, reading the lessons learned report, what you guys took on right in Mobility Guardian, and you took on a lot.
Yep.
So I want to talk a little bit about some of the, I won't say conclusions, some of the insights that you gleaned on that.
Okay. Well, I mean, let's start with the very basic terms. You talk about we are the joint force maneuver. Is I'm both supporting ACE and doing ACE, but I'm also doing every other service's agility concept. Marines, it's EABO or the Littoral Force. For the Army, it's MDTF. For the Navy, it's MDO. I mean, so there's all these concepts out there that need supported. As independent as each service thinks they are, the realities of my 34-year career have an experience that says nobody's as agile and maneuverable as they think they are. So these are big, huge moves. And that's beyond just the getting them into theater. What do you do when you get there? So this maneuver is a big deal. And when we're talking about the lethality that the potential adversary exists, I mean, that's real back to World War II style maneuver warfare. Enormous amounts of risk, enormous amounts of opportunity, and enormous strategic decisions when you talk about the amount of forces that you put into play to be successful. So this maneuver piece is pretty big. I fear the past that you talked about, the sins of efficiency, the sins of just a tip-fit-oriented mindset, basically devolves your participation to just a math equation. How much do I have to move? What's my capacity equals how many days it takes to get there? If that's the way we're going to address our adversaries in the Pacific, then we might as well not even fight. It'll be mired down in efficiencies as opposed to what does it take to make us effective? So that joint force maneuver is a big deal. That's where I get the insights on the joint force isn't as ready, integrated, as agile as they think they are. Nobody is, including us. We learned that in Mobility Guardian. When I talked about our three biggest insights, and these became fairly clear, they revealed themselves like on day three for me. The first one being command relationships matter. I mean, enormously. Command and control, and then what we're calling explode into theater, which is basically the fundamentals. When just to chisel on that one a second is, what we learned that frustrates us with the joint force, we did to ourselves as well. So just the basic blocking and tackling, the paperwork, the flight plans, the load plans, the HAZDECs, the plan for refueling, how do you clip your way through those things so that you're not handicapped by a bureaucratic process and you can actually get after the pace and tempo that you need to get after. So we've got plans for each one of those. I'm certain you'll ask about them, but I was pleased with those insights and felt that even though they revealed themselves on day three, by day 20, I was even more resolved that those were about the top three.
I want to talk a little bit about a couple of those. We talk a lot about the future environment and denied, integrated. They've almost become buzzwords that are included in everything. You eliminate the buzzwords and you say very clearly, C2 is the first casualty of war.
Yep.
I'd like to talk about what exactly that means, because at the same time, oftentimes we think, oh, we lose C2, we lose the AOC. And that's not entirely accurate either. The AOC is still a pivotal element.
Right.
And so I want to talk a little bit about that, what you guys learned there to maybe help airmen understand the C2 problem.
Absolutely. I don't think it's asking too much for airmen to know who they're working for. I mean, that at its most basic sense, you want to say, who's my boss? And it's not just like a need to know who you're working for, but everything that comes with it. Are the priorities established? Do I have conflicting priorities amongst two or three folks that I might think are my boss? So this C2, which has a Comrel aspect to it, you can't talk Comrel without C2, and you can't talk C2 without Comrel. And then how do you still keep action when those things start going away? And they will be challenged. And this is much greater than just an AOC going away. This is the person I'm working for describing the priorities clearly. Are those priorities meeting with the realities of the operational environment? Is there a feedback mechanism going back to command echelons so they can understand if they need to adjust their priorities? Is there unity of effort amongst competing command echelons? Are those competing priorities known to the other entities? So when it comes to C2 and Comrel especially, I mean, this is a PhD level stuff, and it's got to address the complexity, but it's got to be simplified in its application. So when I say it's not asking too much for an airman or a crew or a name anybody on the ground, whether you fly, fix, or support, it's not asking too much for them to know who they're working for, what the priorities are, and what the relationship is as we run around the OODA loop a gazillion times a day to figure this out. So I'm a big Nimitz fan. I think you might know that. You see more than just shadows of Nimitz in both the original manifesto and the, but I mean, his approach to the warfighting principles and simplicity is in there. And I think that's where we need to go. I think we've overcomplicated the conversation and for decades have undertrusted our crew's ability to understand very broadly what commander's intent is and their ability to receive mission type orders and then just to move out.
So one of the things that struck me reading the lessons learned report, your command pushed the limits, what we'll call the policy limits, the regulations. You personally bought a lot of risk in this. I was the primary author on 1-1, and we struggled with prudent risk. Because I would say the Air Force, we understand how to analyze risk.
Yeah.
But it is difficult to define prudent risk, and that can only be defined by a commander.
Yes.
And we'll say, we'll push it down to the lowest practical level, lowest possible level. What does prudent risk mean to you? What is the lowest possible level? How do I make those decisions?
It's great. That's a great question. I used to have a line in one of my wing commander documents, only take the risk that you're responsible for. But even that gets into a very cloudy and murky place. When my squadron commander's course, which we're on the verge of starting the last series during my tenure here in January, I've got a block on risk. So I'll walk you through a few things here. Are you familiar with my Pilot Plus One program where we flew a single pilot in a KC-46 with a boom operator in the co-pilot seat? So in getting after the tempo required to win, we understand, and this is part of my max endurance operations that we executed during Mobility Guardian 2, is that because we're the most relied upon force, I don't foresee a whole lot of crew buses taking you to building, 16-hour crew rest, come back the next day, get your box lunch, and go. If you're on the ground inside the second island chain, you're at high risk, and so we need to keep this momentum going. So we're experimenting with crew days that are in the upper 30s and the lower 40s. It's not something we would do back-to-back, but for example, for our explode into theater or for a big maneuver that needed to happen, I absolutely foresee mobility forces executing high 30s and low 40 crew days. So, you know, now's the time to work on that. It's not, we don't want to figure it out while it's happening. In fact, we just hosted a human performance symposium here last week where we brought in industry partners and other DoD entities to look at how do we get humans to be able to do that. Well, one of the original efforts in this was Pilot Plus One. Just because the plane has two pilot seats doesn't necessarily mean it needs to have two pilots in them. So we were experimenting with, hey, if I got a pilot in a boom that can operate the mission, can I have a pilot in a boom in a crew bunk in the back, essentially getting their crew rest on the airplane? And then, especially with the KC-46 that can both receive and give fuel, I can essentially unlock an enormous amount of capability if I can figure this out. So there are people that think that because there is not two pilots in the seat, then the plane is instantly doomed to crash. Okay. And so this risk came out very early in my tenure here. You know, of course, there was the kerfluffles in the social media space here. You know, my intent is to provide combat capability for America. LeMay, at the end of the day in the Pacific, chose bombs and gas over a radio operator and a co-pilot on some of the B-29 missions. So I'm not comparing myself to LeMay, even though I would take that as a compliment. But I am saying these are operational decisions that America needs to win. So to risk, first of all, I view risk in the same murkiness that, back to Nimitz, that Nimitz viewed risk when he talked about if you can impose a cost to the enemy, paraphrasing here, but greater than the loss that may happen, then feel free to close on the enemy and kill. So scientists are always dissatisfied with that conversation. If you're a one or a zero person and you need to be a scientist and understand exactly the things that you're allowed to do or not to do with risk, then we will never move forward on this. So you've got to be an artist when it comes to risk. So the three categories that we got after on this Pilot Plus One is one, understanding the risk, two, mitigating the risk, and three, owning the risk. In the understanding the risk category, it's not fair to take risk and not know the second and third and fourth order effects. So when I was a co-pilot in my first squadron, I had an aircraft commander who used to say, you got to know the rules to break the rules. That was a very crude way of saying, know the risk, understand the risk. What are the AFIs that apply? What are the FAA guidance that apply? What are the airspace things that apply? What is the most likely outcome? What is the most dangerous outcome? Point here, if you base your arguments not to do something always on the most dangerous outcome, you will never get off the X when it comes to risk. We do a disservice intellectually to the argument when every counter is about the worst case scenario. You'll crash. You'll die. We've never done that before. If we do it for this one, we'll have to do it for everybody. Those are the catcalls of I'm comfortable with the status quo. And we very rarely analyze the risk of the status quo. So the risk of the status quo when it comes to this is if we can't keep the tempo up in the Pacific, we will lose. You know, this is a tempo thing. All right, so lay down all of your understanding of risk, that risk. And then in the mitigate it, it's fairly intuitive here. What can you do to mitigate? Can I fly the crews in a simulator and do the pilot in the left seat and a boom operator in the right seat and go through all the emergency procedures? Yes. Can I have a standing IP that can jump in the right seat in case there's something extremely catastrophic that warrants a swap of crews? Can I execute the mission in a crawl, walk, run fashion? Let's do around the pattern, just a basic IFR pattern first. Then we're going to go from that pattern to a out to the area and back. And then once we go out to the area and the back, we'll do a receive AR and then a give AR, and we'll go back and forth on that. We'll make sure the weather is VFR. We'll do these things. We'll have these waivers. We'll make sure we've notified these people. We'll use airspace where they don't have to worry about other traffic. I mean, all those things are under the mitigating of the risk. And then owning the risk is the most important part. We all know people that own risk, I would say, in a way that has no dignity. If PMAC were to walk up to me today and say, I was up all night with a sick kid, I'm going to work all day, and then I'm going to get on the road and drive 14 hours to see my mom and dad for Christmas. Bye. That's not owning the risk. That's giving the risk to me. And one, he would never do that, but that would be an example of, I'm just giving you my risk. That's on you if it goes bad. And so you got to own the risk that doesn't do that. You got to own the risk in a way that allows your supervisors and upper echelons to understand what's going on, but also for them to know that the risk is on you. We did that with this event. I wasn't asking permission from the upper echelon, but I certainly knew that there was enough risk that it needed to be, they didn't need to find out about it in arrears. So, boss, here's what I'm doing. Here's how I understand it. Here's the mitigation I took. Here's the ownership I have going forward. I'll call you when this mission is flown as fragged, which is exactly the way it went. I mean, this might not surprise you, but it turns out our enlisted are amazing. I mean, I'm being goofy here. They are amazing. They can raise the gear and run a checklist and talk on the radios, okay, to Q1 standards. And so we demonstrated we could do it. We could do it safely. I don't see this as a routine thing. I don't foresee this as a tool that I use every day. I certainly haven't done it in the national airspace, but this is a tool that we could use in the Pacific now that gets after that tempo. So through that meandering discussion of risk, you know, what I want to show is the understand, the mitigate, the own part. And then you got to do that in a thousand times a day if you're a maneuvering airman in the Pacific. Teach the culture that in order to take the risk, I've got to understand it, I've got to mitigate it, and then I've got to own it. You know, I used to say, and I still stand by this, only take the risk you have to. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And so only take the risk you have to. I think our airmen are more than capable of this. They certainly demonstrated it in OAR. When you look at all that happened during that evacuation, it's the whole crowd, the fly fix support crowd that can do that. I established spins that we operated under that are the spins that we would use if a crisis were to go down in the Pacific. They were very aggressive. Some crews used them to the full extent. Some crews admired them a bit. When that's what I want to get after, I want to establish the trust that the command echelon up here has their back if it doesn't go right, and that they can use the full measure of the authorities that I'm giving them.
I do want to move on, but I think this risk discussion is one of the most important going on in the Air Force right now. And there's something that happened here that I think is really interesting to pull apart. As I've gone around briefing the Mission Command doctrine, there's a lot of leadership at the lower levels that goes, okay, I know what risk I'm going to take if we go to war. I understand that. And I understand how I'm going to mitigate that. I've thought about it. But very little testing happening prior to going to war. What you outlined in Beyond the Manifesto, and I am jumping ahead here, but you talk a lot about how the airmen need to know how these additional long days is going to affect them. And what you've done here is allow airmen to test themselves and get to know themselves. You talked about the human performance, and I thought that was a really interesting point. I don't mean to oversummarize you, but I wanted to pull that out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the part of this is really trying to define what the fight's going to look like. Can you add more to the equation than they're going to be able to strike us at long ranges, hold custody on us, both in the air and on the ground, Second Island, Jane Inn, or whatever it is? I believe in my heart that there's more permissive than non-permissive in that theater, even though the threat rings are very, very large. So then describe to a crew what it's going to look like. If you're a tanker crew, you are going to fly extremely long days. You're going to minimize all your ground times. I'm going to authorize that you land on taxiways and runways that perhaps have battle damage on them. If you're an airlift crew, I'm going to authorize non-traditional loading and certification of cargo. I'm going to authorize all day long extended crew days at aircraft commander discretion, what it takes to win. And then what does it look like for squadron commanders that you can task, double task, have crew rest waiver authority, all that stuff? What's it look like for wings? You have the ability to move forces around at your leisure without a whole bunch of bureaucracy on top trying to second guess you. So this accurate description of the type of decisions that the command echelons and the crews will be making, you need to be precise on that. When they need to be addressed in your spins. So the only way we get to the effortless use of those in crisis and conflict is if we actually rehearse them and do them in competition and low crisis. We got to build that trust. We talked about it on the last question, but you've got to build the trust that gets after that prudent risk-taking. We learned some hard lessons in Mobility Guardian through a line on my February order, which I'm certain you're tracking. I said, I'm not interested in hurting anybody permanently, killing anybody, Class A. But those are things that are a part of our business, and I don't want them to happen, but I don't want to lose more. I don't want to lose to a potential adversary more. So we have got to have this environment, and this is something that we've got to take back, okay? The Air Force used to be famous for risk-taking, and we've certainly become less risk-taking, and it involves in-depth discussions when it comes with it. I mean, if you look in our culture, all of the things that we've done as an Air Force that have walked back our ability to take risk. We wouldn't even let people wear open-toed shoes into a DFAC in a deployed environment where you are servicing the enemy on a daily basis. Let's be clear. Okay, there's a part of this where I talk about learned helplessness. This is not the crew's fault. This is not the people that fly fix support's fault. This is an application of commander's inability to tolerate risk and failure that has resulted in a regression of what the Air Force foundationally stood for when it mutinied in 1947. So as it's atrophied, we need to put that same amount of concentration on bringing it back. This all boils down to trust. Trust from the operators, and when I mean operator, I mean fly fix support, trust upward that the command echelons, one, will uphold the standards, certainly. Two, have a disciplined approach to the way we operate, but that they know that the command echelon has their back. And then trust down to the operators that because of the environment we're setting, that they are going to get after the mission when it comes to the mission type orders and what they need to do.
If I had to put a theme on everything we've talked about and what I've seen beyond the manifesto, is leadership matters.
Yep.
The leadership we have now, aggressive, lean forward, that's the direction we want to go.
Right.
You come out and you say, leadership is the most important fundamental of joint air mobility. And I certainly am getting that feel in this conversation. I get that out of the beyond the manifesto. I get that with, we are the joint mobility force. And there's a fantastic quote, and I'm sorry I'm stealing it from you here, but I have to say it. Amateur study tactics, pro study logistics. We've all heard this.
Yeah.
But what we haven't heard is victor study maneuver.
Yes.
And you really are driving the force on that. So I want to talk about the future of AMC, what right. we've learned, this new paradigm that you want AMC airmen, which they are already shifting to. I want to get into that and hear where are we heading, where are we going?
Yep. The executive summary of the Beyond the Manifesto essentially gets to this. I want irreversible momentum on the trajectory that AMC's on. So how do I, in the remaining 8 months of my command, establish a foundation for the next leader to build on that's solid and ready for more? That is huge for me. You know, certainly airmen, the second bullet, are still the magic. And there's this be ready. This is not a 5 years thing. This is not a 10 years thing. This is a be ready. And even when it comes to the current operations that happened in the Middle East with respect to Israel and Gaza, I could not be more pleased with Air Mobility Command's ability to really explode again to another op. We've got to shape the environment as mobility airmen. This gets to the mobility truths that are in the Beyond the Manifesto. We have proven time and time again that we can react to the environment and be extremely successful. OAR is an example of that. Ukraine's an example of that. Any earthquake, any typhoon, any humanitarian, we are wonderful at reacting. But in this big, big adversary challenge, how do we shape the operational environment? I saw that extremely well done over the last 80 days or so when it comes to what this team did for the current Middle East crisis going on right now. Could we explode into theater with our lift? Could we explode into theater with our tank? Could we explode into theater with our air medical evacuation? Could we explode into theater with our global air mobility support system, all the ground stuff? And could we actually shape the environment? And we certainly proved that we could. So it's a good thing. When you do all that effort and you get in and then you're talking about bringing them home because they're bored, that's actually a good thing. As an operator, I wouldn't have wanted that when I was Captain Minahan. I want to get after it. But from the strategic sense that you demonstrated will and a readiness that actually had an effect on an adversary's calculus, that's an extremely good thing to have. And then the final thing is, how can we grow from disorder? How do we go stronger from uncertainty? We are going to have to go into theater and grow stronger every day. That is incredibly essential. That's both in terms of our capability, our confidence, our mission type orders, the risks that we take. All those things are determining factors in our ability to grow from disorder, to grow stronger from the uncertainty, all that stuff. So moving forward, I described this when I spoke at the Air Force Ball on the 75th anniversary of the Air Force 2 years ago. I think at the 100th year anniversary, I'll be like 80, right? And so I challenged the team there. I want to speak at the 100th anniversary here at Scott in the hangar. What do I want? I want to walk into that hangar. I told them I want to still fit in my mesh dress, hopefully. But I want airmen that are better on their average day than I was on my best day. I want a force like that, that is just it completely organized, trained, equipped, completely in tune, motivated with the full capacity to be better on their average day than I was on my mess day. And then I want a fleet that doesn't look anything at all like what we operate today. I'm just going back to, I think we got a little bit complacent with what we demand, especially out of the mobility. This is the original genesis of the manifesto, is we've got complacent when it comes to the kit that mobility flies. So we are still flying the second generation of tanker that this country ever built. Okay, the second tanker this country ever built is still the backbone of my tanker force and will be for the next 20 years. Okay, I'm not knocking the airplane. It's an amazing airplane. The only thing more amazing than the airplane are the crews that fly, fix, and support them. Okay, but we're not operating the second fighter this country ever built. We're not operating the second frigate that this country ever built. We're not operating the second tank that this country ever built. And to put our airmen in a position to be operating an airplane that is so far behind what it has to support and so far behind what the threat is going to present, then we are doing a disservice to those that fly, fix, and support it. So I want a fleet out there that actually honors the dedication of the people that fly, fix, and support by giving them the technology that they need to win. So NGAS, next generation air refueling systems, NGAL, next generation airlift, I view those as systems, not just one airplane. So whatever follows the C-17, whatever follows the KC-46, I think we'll have subset of airplanes within those that there's some that probably look a lot like what we have today, but there's others, especially you get closer into the WES and closer to the threat, that are more, I don't want to say they're stealth, but they're more stealth-like. I don't want to say they're VTOL, but they're more VTOL-like, that can handle the full spectrum. We tend to treat things now like they got to handle every spectrum, as opposed to, hey, look, I need a niche that can escort the fifth and sixth gen inside the high WES. I need a niche that can easily handle the strategic, most of the operational, a little bit of the tactical, and then I need some that just need to be the big bus drivers and the big tanker in the sky in a completely permissive environment. There's a lot of real estate on mobility aircraft, both tanker and lift, that is underutilized. So every hard point, every hatch, every window needs to have good power and good pipes. We need to have open architecture when it comes to the things we put on these airplanes. So I can bring my own EW, I can bring spoof, I can bring decoy, I can bring PNT, I can bring something that comes off my airplane and goes and surveys the airfield I'm about to go land on because I don't know the status of the runway, or carry a life raft to a downed airman, or a radio to a maneuvering ground element that needs a radio. So we got to get back to the effects-based thinking that LeMay and Mitchell were famous for and get off of this platform. Cargo aircraft can only do cargo. Tank and aircraft can only do gas. We got to get back into multiple effects. So you'll see that I talk about game changers a lot. Max endurance operations, certainly one of them. Maneuver battle management is up there, but these palletized effects are big, and it's not palletized effects only kinetic. It's palletized effects when it comes to the full spectrum of capabilities. So when I'm 80, I want there to be, have there be the collective last 25 years. And I want to see that in the airman, and I want to see that in the kit that's on the flight line. I'll say one more thing. You know, my grandfather is an Army Air Corps plank holder, 1943, all the way up to the 70s. I mean, that dude, but if he showed up, first of all, he would recognize the KC-135. Okay. He would recognize it. And not anything that we're buying now would he be surprised by. That's where the pilot sits. That's the stick. That's the throttle. There's the ADI. I mean, he would go through it. That looks like a radio to me. I mean, he might not be able to operate it, but he would not be flummoxed by anything that he's seeing. So let's be aspirational in our demand on our kit and really push the boundaries again on what it means to be. I don't want to be the best Air Force. I want to be the most lethal force on the planet. Civilians decide how we use it based in readiness that can either deter or decisive victory. All that stuff applies. But let's be extremely aspirational on the kit we're buying for our airmen.
Sir, I think a lot of that comes from not just building. One of the things we talk about in the five C's of Mission Command when we brief is the idea of capability. And one of it is not solving the problems that I'm trained for.
Yep.
Solving the problems that I have. I think you've taken that to a platform level. Let's think about what we ask for and what we do in terms of the problems we have and how we can move those.
Yeah.
In the U-28, I often brief my crews that I understand that the crew on this aircraft exceeds the capability of the aircraft. And that pisses me off.
Yeah.
Because I know that the aircraft can be more,
yeah,
but I still need you to be more.
No, I love it. Especially you say that and I go back to OAR, right? You just go, this gets back to the tenacity, and the gap between what you have and what you need is filled by tenacity and courage. So there's always a place for tenacity and courage. Let's take it to a whole new level because they're not filling in the basic gap. That they're filling in the gap that goes from incredible to amazing. You know what I mean? OAR is a great example. You know, they're not trained to analyze thousands of Afghanis coming across the flight line, but they made it happen. they're not trained to bring 600, 500 and above evacuees in the back of the airplane, but they made it happen. They're not trained to deliver babies in the back of airplanes, but they made it happen. There's a lot to celebrate there, but the celebrate needs to be met with an aggressive, aspirational drive. Just decide to do this, to marry or to meet that investment that they gave us with a headquarters and an organized train equip that takes it to a new level.
I want to talk a little bit, just because OAR, we use as a case study for Mission Command in terms of the term you use is leadership in the absence of leadership. And right. I think OAR and the work there in Kabul and by your crews absolutely showcases that. What I'd like to talk about off of that is this idea of learned helplessness. You talked a little bit about that, and I'll read you right out of the glossary here. It says, a state of being in which an individual believes they have no control of their situation, that any effort to change is futile, lack an agency over outcomes, positive or negative, in a person's immediate control. And this next part really caught me. It's manifested in units and larger organizations with terms such as support, enabler, or non-operational. And a majority of our force is not flying a fighter, or they're not special operations, but they are the key pieces of our force.
You got it.
And I often run into airmen that I think have exhibited some of that learned helplessness that we talked about. And how do leaders, and I don't mean just commanders, I mean leaders across the force, how do we lead past this and set that paradigm, set that irreversible momentum?
Right. First of all, it's not their fault. That's the real first of all. Learned helplessness is not the person that feels helpless's fault. That's a reflection of senior leadership. Okay. That's a reflection of not understanding risk taking. That's a reflection of not truly meaning Mission Command, or truly meaning I've got your back if it doesn't go right. Okay. I'm not trying to walk around accountability, the appropriate measures of accountability, the appropriate measures when it comes to disciplined operations. Those are all in stone for a reason, right? First, to address the enablers portion here, that's part of the problem here, and thus the original manifesto. I don't know if you view the manifesto as provocative, but you should have seen the first draft, okay? That was definitely provocative, okay? Not that I walked away from being provocative, but I wanted to make it about the journey and not just about the initial splash into the pool, right? But this is about those four guiding things. When I'm focusing on the lethality piece, is I'm tying everything we do to lethality, okay? The Air Force, force is intentional, okay? At the end of the day, this is about lethality. It doesn't mean that I'm pulling a trigger. It doesn't mean that I'm executing a kill chain, although it could in the future, okay? This means that everybody else's success is dependent on our ability to make them successful. So tying every airman fly fix support to lethality and to their role in lethality is extremely important. If you go back and look at my February order, I'm trying to do that, okay? I'm trying to put tension on the amount of gain that we need in a very short time. I'm trying to put everybody on notice all the way down to the newest airman that this is about you individually. This is not about you in terms of the 110,000 people in Air Mobility Command. This is about you. There is an adversary out there thinking about you in terms of how am I going to kill you and stop you from doing your mission, okay? So leadership needs to tie every individual to lethality and to their role in making it happen. And then to finally bust that thing is you got to completely empower them. So it's not their fault that they think that they need to call the AOC for every movement and approval. I mean, that's something we did. Learned helplessness, not because they learned it on their own, it's because that's what we taught them to do. So let's teach them something different. Let's start with, I trust you. You're an amazing aircraft commander. You're an amazing shift supervisor. You're an amazing guard mount chief. You name it. Let's teaching them that I trust them, okay? And then give them that trust and give it to them in terms of what they can do now, how they can take risks, how they'll be supported, how to have a structure that can get after the risk, and just start doing it. We had an amazing amount of things go right in Mobility Guardian, and we had some things that need significant improvement right off the bat. We had teams that rolled into theater and did exactly what we wanted. There was a crew rested in the back, the jet got more fuel, the lav serviced, and then that crew launched the jet in 2 or 3 hours and got after the employee. We also had crews show up and look around for the crew bus and call the AOC and not take aggressive action and therefore didn't make the VOL the next day. I'm not knocking them, but those are the things that we're getting after in some of the AAR parts. So really describing to them how they fit and really building that trust so that they know that the risks they can take are big things. I'll tell one story here. I went to Airman Leadership School here at Scott 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. I mean, it's been a bit, but it was, hey, we had a discussion on accelerate, change or lose. We had a discussion on risk. And I said to the class of 50, describe how you're accelerating, changing, or describe how you're taking risk. And a bunch of hands went up and it would be like, be more aggressive. Okay, that's good. But give me an example. Nothing. And that went around 5 or 6 times where there's no real answer to show me what you accelerated or changed or give me an example of risk. These are all staff sergeant, about to be staff sergeants, all that. And they had nothing. That's not their fault. That's a master sergeant, senior, chief, captain, colonel. That's their issues. So I said, I'll come back tomorrow. And the homework now is show me something in your unit that you can accelerate change or take risk on. And the next day was amazing. Now, I'm not looking to have an aircraft mechanic work on me in the dental clinic. Okay? I'm not looking for that. I'm not looking to blow off compliance and checklists and stuff like that. But how can you get after those things that establish that trust to that level? Because this is the level that matters most, right? The young staffs out there. And start building on that. And their ideas are wonderful. Like actionable. And there was everything in there from dental tech. There was some JTACs in there. I mean, there was the full spectrum of airmen in there. And each of them had wonderful things. So that's on us. That's the learned helplessness. I'm reading all these documents. I see these articles on it. But how does it relate to me? Now, I lied. One more thing. My February order, in the aftermath of that, and the questions I was receiving, I said, I was in a big group, I'd say, who in here as a supervisor sat down with their airman with the printed order and went over it line by line and had a discussion on how does this relate to us? How does this relate to our mission? How does this relate to, the boss says, take risks. What are some risks we can take? That's like where you want to go, right? I mean, that's the discussion you have. So that's how you get after tying that lethality and that maneuver to the airman. This has got to be, at the end of the day, the old dude, 4-star with gray hair, about to retire, is not going to be who connects with the youngest airman. I can start the conversation, but I'm required, engaged, passionate, understanding leadership at every level to sit down at every echelon and walk through what risk-taking means, what lethality means, what maneuver means as it relates to their mission set.
Sir, thank you. This has been incredible. I want to look at when you published that order, you shook things up. Part of accelerating change, if you look at any of the academics on how do you make change, first you got to kind of take things apart. You got to shake things up. And so if I'm sitting there as a leader, if I'm a senior NCO or I'm a young commander and I know I got to change, I know I got to shake things up. So when you think I want to shake things up and I want to lead us through this change, what is your advice to senior NCOs and FGOs?
Yeah, well, you heard threads of it, and I'll add a few things. You heard threads of it throughout this conversation. First is that risk part, understanding, mitigating, and owning. Sit down with your peer group, your trusted agents, and figure out what that means for you. When it comes to the lethality and the maneuver, I think we hit that hard in the last. You've got to intimately tie everybody to the mission. Your value to the mission has zero to do with your proximity to the cockpit. Okay, so whether you fly, fix, or support, or whether you're in, name any supporting agency, your value to the mission has nothing to do with your proximity to the cockpit. Yet, this is the United States Air Force, okay? This is about cockpits. This is about putting lethal effects on the adversaries of our nation. So it's important that we understand we can say those things and not slight anybody. Just because you don't wear a flight suit or just because you don't strap on an airplane for a living doesn't mean that you're less important than anybody else that does that. So, I mean, this is critical things. Some days it's hard to see your connectivity to the cockpit and the lethality that it gives. I realize that. So, but this is why we have incredibly talented senior NCOs and officer corps, right? You have to do the math on that. You can't just walk away from those conversations. Okay, so this is what it means. When I say, you know, when you listen to the NCO creed, the senior NCO creed, the chief creed, you listen to what the oaths really say. The most important line of my oath is, well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which I'm about to enter. Okay, it's both an accumulation of all the lines above it, and it's the one closest to God. So help me God. So I have an obligation there that penetrates through the challenges, that has to penetrate through whatever the sensitivities are there that may not agree. So this resolve, when it comes to our mission, is incredibly important, okay? It doesn't always mean you'll be popular. It doesn't always mean the leadership will be pleased with you. It doesn't always mean that the social media won't be kicking the crap out of you, okay? Now, I talk about these things in terms of three W's, which is really three W's to make four, okay? Can you will things into existence? Just decide to make it so and do it. Will things into existence. Can you wither the internal resistance? Most of the resistance when it comes to change and accelerate and risk is internal. It's your own team, okay? Can you weather the personal and professional attacks, especially in today's environment? Okay, because there's no difference between personal and professional anymore, especially in the social media. Can you weather that? And not just you, your family. Okay, and if you can do those three W's, then you can win. You can win it no matter what you want to do. You can win at the change. You can win at the risk. You can win at the mission command. You can win in the mission type orders. You can win in every category when it comes. Those four W's are pretty good. I got a question when I was visiting SAS, and I didn't pick it up perfectly when I took the question when I was there. It was a similar question to the one you laid out. It was talking about, hey, this change is really hard. What's your advice for how to really get after it? So I had a lot of examples when it came to how do you set up a structure? How do you set up a counter structure? How do you do things mechanically within a staff to make change happen? But I didn't talk about what it takes for the individual. The very early stages of, hey, I got an idea. This is where I think I want to go. Do I pull in close group of trusted agents? Do I pull in like-minded people that I think in the squadron or unit have a similar idea? Do I go outside of the unit and talk to someone, a mentor, a former commander, a former chief or supervisor that had a similar experience? Those things are all necessary in the early stages. Do I pull in a cadre of trusted agents that maybe are retired or have moved on that I know that can tell me what I need to hear, not what I want to hear? Those things are all part of the steps, especially in the very early stages. How do I put enough momentum on my vision that I can get out of that stage early with confidence? Hopefully that makes sense. Confidence is a part of this. So the individual factors, maybe for a future podcast, I think are good because especially, I'll share this publicly the first time right now, especially in February when the order came out, and I thought about, please do not think that I'm comparing myself to like a Mitchell or anybody like that, but you got to wonder in those early stages when the kerfluffle's happening, am I doing the right thing here? Because it sure feels kind of hot right now in the hot seat. You get what I'm saying? So, but that's where you double down on the resolve. Okay. And that's where the payoff in advance of the direction that you're giving gets you through those normal human moments when you're going, all right, well, it didn't quite go the way I wanted. The response was perhaps not exactly what I was anticipating, but I've got the resolve to see this through and continue the track.
That's going to do it for this week's podcast. The show is recorded, edited, and produced by the LeMay Center's Doctrine Outreach Section. Special thanks to General Mike Minahan, the team at AMC Headquarters, the LeMay Center, and Air University. As always, the views expressed by our panel members are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Air University, the Air Force, or any government agency. I'm Nicholas Underwood. We will see you next time.